Radio.
In What Sort of Darkness? A clarification of the Christian understanding of the act of faith in response to atheist misunderstandings. A presentation by Dr. Brendan Triffitt at the Christopher Dawson Center for Cultural Studies 2015 Colloquium.
I'd like to write a short book that challenges what I call the doctrine of blind faith, or the doctrine of blind belief, and I've written it up there. Whether or not God exists, faith in God is completely blind. That's what the doctrine of blind faith is, or blind belief. It's my contention that the doctrine of blind belief is based on a misunderstanding of what faith is and how believers experience and live out their faith. To illustrate what I mean by blind faith, I made up this fictional story. Some of you will probably work out which movie I've been inspired by. Imagine that you were born and raised in a relatively primitive society. The society is completely self-contained. The land which this society inhabits is surrounded by an impenetrable dome. Let's suppose that the dome extends so far down that nobody can dig under it. There is absolutely no way of knowing what might be on the other side of the dome, if indeed there is anything at all. As far as anyone knows, there is no way of breaching the dome from the inside. As far as anyone knows, nothing on the outside of the dome has ever made its presence known to the people inside. All sorts of legends have been written about the other side. These have been handed down from generation to generation. But there's no way of testing whether any of these legends are true. For the sake of argument, let's agree that there is no way of deducing what things might be like on the other side based on how things are on the inside, using the methods of science or philosophy or whatever. Now, suppose that one day you read one of these legends and you decide that it is true. For the sake of argument, let's agree that you are not gifted with clairvoyance or supernatural inspiration or anything like that. You go to your family and assert in their presence, excitedly, that there truly is an other side. There are other lands and other beings on the other side of the dome. You go on to give detailed descriptions of what those lands and beings are like. You end by saying that the greatest of the beings on the other side is an immortal shape-shifting beast called Both. All right, anyone know what movie I was thinking about with the dome? No, I'll have to ask you about that. But the dome thing came from The Truman Show, 1998 film. So the person who affirms the existence of Both does so from a place that is closed in on itself phenomenologically. What's that word mean, phenomenologically? A phenomena is something that manifests itself, that reveals itself, that shows itself. So this land that's inside the dome is sealed in on itself phenomenologically. Nothing can manifest itself from the outside to the inside, or at least nothing does. So here's my working definition of a completely blind belief. It's a belief that reaches out from the believing person, the subject, to some supposedly transcendent object. In the absence of any manifestation that reaches from the object to the believing subject. That's rather complex language. What I mean, in short, is a completely blind belief is a belief that's not called forth by the object of belief. So think of it like this. Belief is an arrow that goes from myself, the believer, to God, the one who's believed in. And manifestation is an arrow that comes from God back to the believer. For a Christian, and probably for other religions too, but we won't look at that. For a Christian, true belief in God is a response to a prior divine call. So there's an arrow that comes from God to the believer first. And your faith, your act of faith, it's carried forth, it's evoked by that call. I thought... A relevant quote there is, "You did not choose me, but I chose you." So it's not that we first decide to believe in God. God decides that we should believe in him, and we respond. Now, agnostics and atheists often speak as if the physical universe were completely closed in on itself, perfectly self-contained. This pattern of thought actually began with deism. Deism arose alongside the scientific revolution in the 17th century. For the deists, God set up the machinery of the universe and then left it to operate on its own. Deists do not believe in the intimate involvement of God in nature, nor do they believe that God intervenes in history and reveals himself personally to mankind. The natural world then is phenomenologically self-enclosed. There's nothing beyond the natural world that manifests itself to the beings in that world. There are no divine self-manifestations that erupt into the realm of the natural universe. Naturalism came along next. Naturalism took this view one step further and did away with the creator. And you can sort of see why. Since a creator who's not needed to sustain the universe and who's not personally involved in the drama of human history is irrelevant anyway. So deism got the whole thing going, and the inevitable result was atheism and naturalism. I'm going to speak of naturalism more in a moment, but my point for now is this. The idea that the physical universe is closed in on itself, like those people in the dome, both metaphysically and phenomenologically, is an idea that begins with deism and finds its logical conclusion in atheism. So, for all intents and purposes, the agnostic is actually in the same boat as the atheist. An agnostic is someone who says that there's no way of knowing whether God exists or not. You know what an atheist is. They both deny that the presence of God is made known in nature and history. Neither of them think that. From their point of view, a believer's belief in God is completely blind, even if God happened to exist. They assume that a Christian's belief in God reaches out from the believer to God, if he exists, but there's no manifestation of God that comes first. So, in order to correct this misunderstanding of the nature of faith, we would do well to reflect on the theme of the call and the response. So, if I were to write this book, I would look at the phenomenology of a Catholic writer called Jean-Luc Marion, who writes a lot about the call and the response in quite interesting ways. I think we do well to return to the reflections of Hans Urs von Balthasar on this too. Just a sentence on him now. He says that we should not emphasize the absence of God so much that faith is reduced to a blind leap made by a desolate will, gritting your teeth and closing your eyes, as Robert said so well. Von Balthasar calls for a counterbalance to the emphases that are found in the writings of Luther and Kierkegaard. He doesn't deny that there are important things said by Luther and Kierkegaard, but he says we need to counterbalance that. He says, a proper understanding of faith should incorporate pistis, which is belief, and gnosis. He's not talking about Gnosticism here. Gnosis here means contemplation. So faith has a contemplative element. By that, he doesn't mean that we should all go and be contemplatives. He doesn't mean that at all moments our faith means that we are actually thinking about God actively. What he means is that the presence, God is somehow present in the soul whenever you actually have faith, even if you're not thinking about God. Today I've only got time to explore one chapter of what would be a larger explanation of the nature of faith. So today I'm going to focus on atheism specifically. There are many different types of atheism, I realised when I started thinking about this. There is the atheism of the communist, and that's really quite different from the atheism of the French existentialists like Jean-Paul Sartre or Albert Camus. There's the atheism of the earth-worshipping environmentalist and the atheism of the self-serving tycoon. They're completely different as well. The type of atheism I want to look at today is different again. This type is marked by an exaggerated confidence in science. This is the atheism that says, I do not believe in God since there is no empirical evidence for his existence. I do not believe in God since there is no empirical evidence for his existence. Now, implicit in that statement is the following claim, and I've written it up there somewhere, T1. That means thesis 1. Given that there is no empirical evidence for God, To believe in God is to harbour a belief that is not informed by anything real out there. Since belief in God is not supported by any physically observable fact or set of facts, it must be an utterly blind leap of faith. Next, I'll need to talk about naturalism and empiricism. Naturalism is the belief that the physical universe is all that there is. This was the idea that came after deism. Deism is like naturalism, except it also said that God exists. But naturalism comes next. On this view, there's no such thing as God or angels or the immortal soul. There was no divine act of creation, no supernatural interventions. The universe is a self-contained system of natural cause and natural effect. All events can be explained in terms of physical processes alone, at least in principle. Such processes involve physical matter, physical energy, and the laws that govern causation. Naturalists will actually admit that certain phenomena cannot yet be explained in terms of known processes. But they don't deny that these phenomena are manifestations of something divine or spiritual. So we don't yet know why certain statues bleed blood, for example, or why some people can do faith healings. We don't understand it, but it is a natural process. Science just hasn't yet got to the stage of being able to explain these things. So someone can be a naturalist and concede that scientists don't have everything worked out. This is that most famous of naturalists, Richard Dawkins, admits that we are currently unable to explain exactly how life came to be out of non-living materials. For naturalists, typically, science is the exemplary form of knowledge, since it is the most certain form of knowledge. Just bear in mind here that science means the physical sciences, such as physics, biology, chemistry, or astronomy. The Latin form of the word scientia, is that right? had a broader meaning in medieval times, as does Wissenschaft in modern German. For naturalists, typically, empirical evidence is the bedrock on which all reasonable assertions are founded. Empirical evidence is evidence delivered to sensuous perception, the eyes, the ears, under appropriate experimental conditions. So next we move to empiricism. That's the claim that physical evidence is the bedrock on which all reasonable assertions are founded, just what I said. Now, given the historical link between naturalism and an exaggerated confidence in science, one can be forgiven for thinking that naturalism always implies empiricism. But actually, things aren't that simple. So a small digression here. One might be a naturalist without being a strict empiricist. And there are two ways that this can happen. One way involves a priori truths. The other involves moral truths. There's some overlap between those two, but that doesn't matter. Most philosophers will admit that there are a priori truths. Truths that we recognise without relying on external observation and experiment. As an example, consider this principle. A physical whole is necessarily larger than its parts, than each of its parts. Or the principle of non-contradiction. It's impossible for something to be X, say hot, and not X, not hot, at the same time and in the same respect. We don't need to survey every object in the universe in order to realise that it is impossible for a part to be greater than the whole of which it is a part. Nor do we need to set up a scientific experiment to see that the principle of non-contradiction is true. Indeed, not only is empirical evidence unnecessary here, it is also insufficient. No matter how much empirical data one gathers together, one can never arrive at a logically necessary truth just by considering that data. For logical necessity cannot be observed, it is not a physical property. Now, to say that there are a priori truths does not yet amount to saying that God exists or that we can have an immaterial soul. True, many philosophers have argued that our intuition of necessary truths points to the existence both of an eternal God and of the soul made in his image. Nevertheless, there are plenty of naturalists around today who admit that there are a priori truth, and I think it's reasonable to say that there are. These philosophers see no contradiction between their admission of a priori truth and their naturalistic atheism. They are not naturalists in the strict sense. I hope that makes sense. Now, there's a second way in which a naturalist might fail to be a strict empiricist, and this is where we get to certain atheist philosophers that I have a lot of sympathy for and respect for. One of them is Raymond Gaita, and another is John Armstrong, who we've had as a guest speaker. These philosophers wax lyrical about higher ideals and transcendent values, but they're still atheists. On their view, human beings can recognise objective moral truths, even though these can't be verified empirically. The intrinsic value of a person can be seen in some way, in a way that compels us to act ethically, but that that value doesn't show up in the physical world like velocity does, or weight, or colour. There are moral truths. It is wrong to torture a child. Justice is to be pursued, and so on. And these moral truths can be recognised, but not using physical observation. They would say that our recognition of these things does involve the body, but it's not just sensual perception. It's a bit like how we recognise beauty. Beauty is not something that can be measured using a scientific experiment, but it does involve sensuous perception still. Now, someone like Augustine would say that the human body manifests the reality of the human spirit. The universe reflects divine order, and our intuition of goodness and beauty in the world is a certain foretaste of divine goodness and beauty. By contrast, Gaita and Armstrong, these thinkers, being atheists, would maintain that the natural world is closed in on itself, both metaphysically and phenomenologically. Metaphysically, because the world's not sustained by God, by the first cause. Phenomenologically, because divine goodness and beauty aren't participated in, reflected in, and reflected in the world, because God doesn't exist. Iris Murdoch is another example of someone who thinks like that, but I might go into her. So to summarise this section, soft naturalists, I'm going to call these soft naturalists, they're naturalists, they don't believe in God or the soul, but it's a soft version of naturalism because they still believe that there are moral principles that we can see. So they're not strict empiricists. And also naturalists who believe in a priori truths, they're not strict empiricists either. Okay, so now I'm going to have a sort of dialogue with the soft naturalist. I believe that he or she has everything right except the naturalism. He's right to believe in the intrinsic value or preciousness of human beings. He's right to say that our belief in the intrinsic value of persons is not based on empirical evidence. And he's right to maintain that our belief in the intrinsic value of persons is nevertheless informed by reality. He's right to maintain that our belief in the intrinsic value of persons is informed by reality. I'm going to focus now on this claim. Whenever we act in a way that is truly ethical, we do not project our values arbitrarily onto the world. By the way, this is all coming from my reading of von Hildebrand. Rather, our ethical actions are informed by reality, by how things are at some fundamental level, by some deep and unchanging order of things. If our moral beliefs were never informed by reality, then our ethical responses to people would never be true responses at all. No action would be any better or any worse than any other, objectively speaking. There'd be nothing deeply true, nothing genuinely good about taking care of a vulnerable child compared with exploiting that child instead, for example. In short, nihilism would be true. But since nihilism is false, it must be that some actions are truly ethical and that these actions are truly ethical insofar as they accord with a true vision of reality. I'll repeat that. True ethical actions are true because they accord with a true vision of reality. I would argue then that reality itself has a moral dimension, a radiant depth that calls forth our ethical responsibility. It is reality itself, in its moral dimension and radiant depth, that informs our thinking and doing whenever we are truly ethical. But to repeat, this true vision of reality is not gained through empirical means. We do recognise the fact that we shouldn't torture a child, but we don't gain that fact, that truth, using scientific experimentation. The soft naturalist agrees to all of this. He maintains that our belief in the intrinsic value of persons is informed by reality, even though it's not grounded in empirical evidence. So he's committed to T2, thesis 2. He's committed to that. A belief need not be grounded in empirical evidence in order to be informed by reality. Now recall T1, which is the claim I want to challenge. I'll read it out. You might not be able to find it. T1 is this: given there's no empirical evidence for God, to believe in God is to harbour a belief that is not informed by anything real out there. Now, T1 implies, uses T3. T3 is this: a belief must be grounded in empirical evidence in order to be informed by reality. The soft naturalist rejects that because they believe that there are objective moral values that we can see. Okay, so it's clear that... I gave the example of an atheist who says, well, I don't believe in God because there's no empirical evidence for him. Well, the soft naturalist can't use that argument because they do believe in some things that there isn't empirical evidence for, i.e. objective moral values. Okay? Good. That's all well and good, I hear you say, but how might an intelligent believer in God respond to T1... which I'm challenging, when it comes from the mouth of a hardened naturalist like Richard Dawkins? One method is as follows. First, force your atheist interlocutor to choose between nihilism and ethical realism. By nihilism, again, I mean the belief that our ethical sensibilities, they're just adaptive projections of value onto the world. On this view, our ethical beliefs and responses don't carry any objective weight or seriousness. There's nothing deeply true about an act of justice or charity, and there's nothing false, really, about torturing innocent children for the fun of it. It may seem as if we are bound by objective moral principles, but that's just an illusion that we have all given ourselves. Freud and Nietzsche and others have told all sorts of stories about how that has happened. Now, actually, the vast majority of people, atheists included, will want to say that there actually is something evil about torturing innocent children for the fun of it. When you really push them, they will admit that, especially if they're on TV at the time. They will be forced then to reject nihilism, and this will then lead them to agree to ethical realism. And by this realism, I mean some of our moral intuitions are true, and they are informed by reality, as I explained before. On this view, ethical realism, to feel repulsed by the idea of someone torturing innocent children, as most people would be, that is to be attuned to reality, to how things are at a fundamental level. But to not feel repulsed is to be out of touch with reality. There's something ethically significant about reality itself that imposes certain courses of actions on our will. These are objective moral principles, and these are not of our own making. Not even consciously, collectively. I'm getting toward the end. So let's assume that you've got your atheist interlocutor to the point of realising that ethical realism must be true. There's no guarantee of this, of course. If a naturalist is not a soft naturalist, then chances are he has put his faith in science. And it seems that everyone who puts their faith in science these days is mentally retarded when it comes to philosophy. I haven't worked out whether the obsession with science causes the philosophical retardation or whether the philosophical retardation causes the obsession with science. More experiments need to be done, I think. Once you've got your interlocutor to this point, your next step is to ask him which empirical facts he relies on when he makes his basic ethical judgments. How exactly does he know that innocent children should not be tortured for the fun of it? He will probably reply like this. It's an objective fact that children, as human beings, have a highly developed brain and central nervous system, that they are self-conscious, that they have deep feelings and emotions, and so on. Well, your response should be as follows. So you believe that a being with these particular properties, i.e. consciousness, sensitivity, affectivity, and so on, you believe that they should never be treated in that way, not even in cultures where torturing someone for the fun of it is considered acceptable and probably serves some social function, perhaps. So how exactly might this morally significant belief of yours, my friend, how will that be empirically verified? Let's assume that your interlocutor is intellectually humble and honest. There's no guarantee of this either. In my experience, those with an obsessive faith in science tend to lack these qualities. Your humble interlocutor, having realised that there is no way of verifying his moral beliefs using science, should now admit that a belief need not be grounded in empirical evidence in order to be informed by reality. If you prod him a little further, he should say, "Yes, I suppose it is conceivable that your belief in God is informed by reality, even though its validity cannot be tested empirically." But, as already indicated, things may not go to plan. Your interlocutor may prefer to bite the bullet and embrace nihilism rather than go along with your reasoning. If that situation should arise, your tactical response is simple. Point out that a nihilist like himself cannot expect to be taken seriously when he exhorts others to be as rational as he is. For if he expects his exhortations to be taken seriously with any ethical weight, then he's not being consistent in his nihilism. And by being inconsistent, ironically, he fails to live up the very standards of rationality that he exhorts others to live by. If his rationalistic ravings also include the claim that religion is the root of all evil, repeat the same point. It's inconsistent and therefore irrational for a nihilist like himself to take the high moral ground against anything. I should warn you, all of this reasoning will fluster your atheist interlocutor terribly. It does not lead to a conclusion that he can easily accept. He wants to present himself as a respectable humanist, one who believes in justice and human rights and basic decency. He also wants to hold up scientific method as the key to all knowledge, and therefore as the key to human liberation. He would exalt rational man as the one who holds the key that unlocks minds from the oppressive grip of superstition. But your own reasoning, hopefully, has shown him that he cannot do both of these at once. If he embraces nihilism, then he cannot present himself as a humanist. He cannot win favour by exuding humanistic optimism. But if he admits that there are objective moral principles, he must now give an account of how he knows these principles. Before you came along, he was able to keep this problem tucked away, or else his philosophical retardation prevented him from noticing the problem in the first place. And since he cannot see how moral principles might be verified using empirical means, he can no longer hold up scientific method as the key to all knowledge. One more paragraph. Don't be surprised if your atheist interlocutor tries to save face in a desperate measure. He may broaden his foundation and admit that reason is the key to knowledge and liberation rather than the scientific method as such. This will allow him to include moral principles in his system of thought while still giving science a special place. But if you push him any further, he will simply dig his heels in. He will make his final appeal to what any reasonable person would think. Any reasonable person can see that he's wrong to torture an innocent child, he'll say. Any reasonable person can see that belief in God is unreasonable. If you ask him one more time why belief in God is unreasonable, he will answer, "Because no one who is reasonable believes in God." In other words, this is what it comes down to. Atheists are in, believers are out. We have determined that belief in God has no place in our community, and that is that. Atheism is necessary for being included in our community of enlightened men, and belief in God is sufficient for being excluded. So often all this talk of enlightened reason comes down to just that, a sheer act of will. One group of men staking out the boundaries of their exclusive in-group by a collective decree in order to define themselves against others. We are reasonable people because we do not believe in God. You are not reasonable people because you still do. All their reasoning begins and ends there, in an arbitrary act of self-determination. The ground of their reasoning is nothing but will. A sheer willing that wills to believe that it is the clarity of pure reason rather than the darkness of sheer will. If through reason you attempt to shatter the delusion, you invoke the wrath of the will that wants to keep the delusion alive.
That was Dr. Brendan Triffitt with In What Sort of Darkness? A Clarification of the Christian Understanding of the Act of Faith in Response to Atheist Misunderstandings. This presentation was part of the Christopher Dawson Center for Cultural Studies 2015 colloquium on the theme Ideas Dangerous to Atheism. For more talks, interviews, and shows, visit cradio.org.au.